So then, no more boasting about men. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future. All are yours, and you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. So then, men ought to regard us as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the secret things of God. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each will receive his praise from God. Now, brothers, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, do not go but what beyond what is written. Then you will not take pride in one man over against another. For who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not? Love does not boast. It is not proud. This is God's word.
We're doing a series in which we're looking at the marks of a supernaturally changed heart. And that means we're not looking so much at morally virtuous behavior. You can do all kinds of morally virtuous things out of a heart filled with fear, pride, and desire for power, or out of a heart that's been actually changed at the root by the grace of God. And so what we're doing is we're looking at the traits of a heart that's really been radically changed by the grace of God. And this particular letter, this passage that was just read to you, it's obviously a letter from Paul to the Corinthians. The Corinthian church was filled with division. The reason for all the references to Paul and Apollos and Cephas was because this church had originally been planted by Paul, but then later on other ministers came through, other speakers, other evangelists came through, and there's different people that had connections to these different prominent ministers. So one person was mentored and discipled by Paul. Another one was mentored and appointed into leadership by Apollos, another great teacher, and so forth. And instead of everybody just being very happy that they had this relationship with Paul or Apollos, these relationships are now the basis for a power play. Parties have arisen. Divisions are tearing the church up. People are saying, I should be the leader because Paul, the Saint Paul, is the one who discipled me. And others said, so what? I have a relationship, and so on. And Paul, in this passage, shows that the root cause for why we cannot get along, the root cause for why there's no peace in the world, why we can't live at peace with each other, is pride and boasting. See, verse 21 starts off, no more boasting. The last verse, chapter 4, verse 7, let's stop the boasting. And especially, let's not have pride, see verse 6, of one man over another. So we're at the trait of humility. We're here to talk about humility. And that means we get into a very, very culturally interesting subject, which is self-esteem. I'll tell you how interesting it is. Up until the 20th century, every traditional culture, and this is still true in most cultures of the world, the traditional cultures have always believed that too high a view of yourself is the real root cause for most of the evil in the world. Most of the crime, the violence, the warlikeness, why do people abuse? Why are people cruel? Why do people do the bad things they do? Traditionally, the answer was hubris. That's Aristotle's term, of course, Greek. Pride. Too high a view of yourself is the reason why we misbehave. But in the modern Western culture, and particularly in the United States, we have an utterly opposite cultural consensus. The basis of our education, of the way in which we treat incarcerated prisoners, the basis of our legislation, certainly the basis of our counseling, in our culture is exactly the opposite of the consensus of all the other societies that have ever lived, and that is our belief today, and it's deeply rooted in everything, it's a cultural consensus, is that people misbehave for lack of self-esteem. because they have too low a view of themselves. The reason husbands beat their wife, their wives, the reason why people are criminals is because they have too low a view of themselves. So traditional culture said the problem is you have too high a view, pride, and too much self-esteem. And then, of course, now we say it's too little self-esteem. Probably these simplistic approaches are going to be jumbled up pretty badly in the next few decades. But did any of you notice February 3rd, New York Times Magazine had an article by Lauren Slater, a psychologist, called The Trouble with Self-Esteem. And it was not a groundbreaking article. It wasn't some new bolt out of the blue. All she was doing was beginning to report what the experts have known for years. And it's what's significant about the article is that there's enough accumulated evidence now that it's starting to come down into the popular consciousness, but it has a long way to go. What she says is that there's no evidence, for the last 15, 20 years, there's no evidence that low self-esteem is a big problem in society. She says, for example, in the article, she says, last year there were three withering studies of self-esteem released in the United States, all of which had the same central message. People with high self-esteem pose a greater threat to those around them than people with low self-esteem. And feeling bad about yourself is not the source of any of our country's biggest problems. Now, it would be fun to go and explain why that works and how that works and so on, but suffice it to say, she's right when she says it will be years and years for modern Americans especially, to accept this. It is so deeply rooted in us that lack of self-esteem is the reason why there's drug addiction. That's the reason why there's abuse and why there's crime and why there's, wife beating and so forth. And she says it's going to take forever. And here's the reason why. Because what's so wonderful about the low self-esteem theory of misbehavior is you have to make no moral judgments in order to deal with these problems. All you have to do is support people and just build them up. In traditional cultures, the way you dealt with these problems was you clamped down on people and you convicted people and you called them bad. We don't want to go back to that, do we? What's intriguing about this passage is it gives us an approach to self-regard, an approach to the self, a way of seeing yourself that is absolutely different than traditional cultures or modern, postmodern, contemporary culture. Utterly different. The three things we learn here is Paul shows us the natural condition of the human ego, and then the supernatural condition that can be brought about through the gospel, and lastly, how to get it. The natural condition of the human ego, the transformed sense of self and identity that Paul had discovered, and how to get it. Ready? First thing we learn is, number one, the natural state of the human self. And he uses a word in verse 6 and that you say, okay, well, sure, I know about that. He says, let's have no more pride. But you have to understand that Paul is using a word pride here that's unusual. And what's really significant about it is it's not the hubris word, it's not the normal word for pride, but it's a word that Paul uses in this particular book 6 times. It's used by no one else in the Bible. It's not even used only by Paul one other place in Colossians. It's used 6 times. It shows up every couple of chapters, and many commentators now realize it's a special theme of Paul. He is trying to help these Corinthians by teaching them something about the human ego by using this particular word. And this word for pride is a word that literally means to be overinflated, swollen, distended beyond its proper size. It's a word that actually it's related to the word for bellows, and it's very evocative and kind of painful. It evokes the image of some organ of the human body that is distended because so much air has been pumped into it that it's ready to burst. It's overinflated, it's distended, it's swollen, it's inflamed, because it's been extended past its proper size, and that, he says, is the condition of the natural human ego. Now, I think because it's so evocative and such an interesting metaphor, we're supposed to reflect on, what does the metaphor mean? What is he trying to say? And here are some things we learn. We learn, first of all, I'll put it this way. The natural condition of the human ego is to be empty, obviously. If it's empty, painful, busy, and fragile. Empty, painful, busy, and fragile. First, empty. The image, first of all, gives us, obviously, that the heart at the center of the human ego, no matter how big it is an emptiness. Soren Kierkegaard, in his book, Sickness Unto Death, says it is the normal state of the human heart to try to build its identity around something besides God. Spiritual pride is the illusion that you are competent to run your own life, achieve your own sense of self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give you meaning in life without God. And what Soren Kierkegaard says is the natural, in other words, the normal human ego is built on something besides God, something that will give you worth, something that will give you a sense of specialness, something that will give you a sense of purpose. And of course, as this is a very well-known metaphor in the history of Christian communication, if you try to put anything in the middle of a place that was originally made for God, it's going to be too small, and it's going to rattle around in there, and therefore, the human ego in the beginning, the first thing we learn is empty. It's empty. And because it's empty, secondly, it's painful. Now, the idea of being distended, the idea of being overinflated, means that it's painful. What do I mean by that? Well, have you ever noticed, no, actually, that's the wrong word, have you ever noticed that you don't notice your body unless there's something wrong with it? For example, I didn't come to church today saying, you know, my toes are just feel great tonight. And my elbow, you know, it just works like a charm. You only would talk like that or think like that if something had been wrong with it. Because parts of your body do not call attention to themselves unless there's something wrong with them. The ego has got something incredibly wrong with it. Yourself, your identity, has something unbelievably wrong with it because it's always drawing attention to itself every single day. How you look, how you were treated. You know, people are always saying, my feelings were hurt. Feelings, how can feelings be hurt? What do feelings taste like? Touch, try to. It's your ego that's hurt. Your feelings are fine. You're having bad feelings about your ego. And you see, you know, just walking around doesn't hurt my toes unless there's something already wrong with them. And yet you can't get through the day without feeling snubbed or feeling ignored or feeling stupid or getting down on yourself or there's something wrong with your identity. There's something wrong with your ego. There's something wrong with your sense of self because it's never happy. It's always drawing attention to itself, okay? So first of all, it's empty, but it's like a bloated stomach that hurts like crazy because it's distended in its emptiness. So secondly, it's painful. Thirdly, because it's empty and painful, the ego is incredibly busy, and this explains what we mean when we say it's always drawing attention to itself, it's incredibly busy trying to fill the emptiness. And it's incredibly busy doing two things in particular, and those two things are comparing and boasting. You see them in here? First of all, notice, he doesn't say in verse 6, then you will not take pride. He says, then you will not take pride in one another over against another, in one man over against another. That's the very essence, the very, very essence of what it means to have a normal human ego. The normal human ego is not only empty, but the way it tries to fill its emptiness and tries to deal with its discomfort, which it is, got incredible discomfort, is by comparing yourself to other people all the time. And C.S. Lewis points out in his famous chapter on pride in Mere Christianity that pride is by nature competitive, that the very, very essence of pride is that you're competitive. And here's the way he puts it. He says, pride is something that's essentially competitive. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only having more of it than the next person. You may think you're proud of being successful or intelligent or good-looking, but you really aren't. You're only proud of being more successful, more intelligent, and more good-looking than other people, and when you are in the presence of people who are much more successful, intelligent, and good-looking than you, you lose all pleasure in what you had because you really had no pleasure in it. You were proud of it. Pride is the pleasure of having more than the next person. Pride is the pleasure of being more than the next person. Lust may drive a man to sleep with a beautiful woman, But at least lust makes him want her. Pride drives a man to sleep with a beautiful woman just to prove he can do it. And to prove that he can do it over the others. Pride destroys the ability to have any real pleasure from her. When I was a junior in high school, maybe this happened to you, my parents kept coming to me, my mother kept coming to me and saying, you know, honey, go out for the chess club. I said, Mom, I hate chess. Yeah, I know, she says, but it would look so good on your college application. She says, why don't you volunteer to do some of that? Don't they feed the homeless and the hungry downtown every Saturday morning? Yeah, Mom, I don't want to go there. I hate that. She says, I know, but it would look so good on your college application. So that my junior year in high school, I just did all kinds of stuff that I had absolutely no interest in doing for itself, but I was putting together a resume. And that is what your ego is doing all the time. You're in jobs that you take no pleasure in. You're doing diets that you take no pleasure in. You're doing all kinds of things that you are not doing for themselves, but you are, by comparing yourself to other people, you're boasting. The word boasting here means to recommend yourself. It means you are creating a self-esteem resume desperate to fill the sense of inadequacy and emptiness. So busy all the time. And lastly, it's not only empty and painful and busy, it's fragile. Because anything that is overinflated is imminently about to be deflated. To be overinflated means you're constantly in danger of being deflated, and you are. People who seem to have no pride because they hate themselves, and they tell you they hate themselves, and they tell themselves they hate themselves, are deflated. To be deflated means you were inflated. You see, if you're puffed up and not filled up, if you're puffed up by air and not filled up with something solid, then to be inflated, to be deflated is all the same thing. To have a superiority complex or an inferiority complex is just the same thing. They're both results of being overinflated, distended, empty, painful, busy, and of course, therefore, fragile. And, you know, I'll just read you a perfect example of this, even though I'm not trying to lift her up as being worse than other people at all. As a matter of fact, she's actually shows a tremendous amount of awareness, and I have a lot of admiration for her. But if you want a perfect example of exactly what we're talking about, here, this is something I lifted years ago out of a Vogue magazine interview with Madonna, in which she was talking about her career, and here's what she says. She says, my drive in life comes from the fear of being mediocre. That's always pushing me. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. But then I feel that I'm still mediocre and uninteresting unless I do something else. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove that I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and I guess it never will. I'll tell you one thing, is she knows herself better than most of us know ourselves. Because look, see, what she's saying is, every time I accomplish something, I say, now I've got the verdict that I'm somebody, and the next day I realize, unless I keep going, I'm not. My ego cannot be satisfied. My sense, my desire for self-worth and to be sure I'm somebody, I need a verdict, and it's not coming, and I keep thinking I've won it from what people have said and from what the magazines have said. Next day, I've got to go somewhere else. Why? Because my ego is insatiable. It's a black hole. It doesn't matter how much I throw into it. The cupboard is bare. I put all kinds of stuff in it every morning, and the next night, it's bare. I still need to... No matter, you know, she said, I've become somebody, and I still realize I've still got to become somebody. He said, well, how neurotic. No, she knows herself. She's ahead of most of us. Now, that's the normal ego state. That's the normal state of the human self. But Paul comes around, and then in the middle of this passage, for their sake, all these people who are fighting over him and saying, I know Paul, and they're just showing all this pride, they can't enjoy the fact they know Paul. They have to use the fact that they know Paul for one-upsmanship on the other people in the church. And so what he does is he says, well, let me show you how I do it. In verses 3 and 4, we have Paul giving us an example of how, now that he understands the gospel, how his own sense of self works, how his own self-regard operates, how his own identity works, and his own ego, in a sense, works. And here's what he does. First of all, he says in verse 3, now, yes, I'm a minister, and I have a job to do, he says in verse 1 and 2. But with regard to it, he says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Huh. In other words, you see what he's saying? I don't care if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Now, the word judge is verdict. It's a word for verdict. It's a thing, by the way, you know, that Madonna's looking for. And what he does is he looks out and he says, one thing I want you to know is I don't care what you think. I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what anybody thinks about me. See, he doesn't just say, I care little if I'm judged by you or by any human body. He says, I have come to the place where my identity owes nothing to what people say. I don't care what you think. I don't care what anybody thinks. My identity, my self-regard, is not tied in any way to your verdict and your evaluation of me. Well, now, a lot of us say, okay, that sounds great. He doesn't seem to be suffering from low self-esteem. No, he isn't. How do you get there? How do you get to the place where people think about you don't control you anymore? How do you get there? Now, almost everybody would say it's very obvious. Every counselor I know practically would go like this. If they met somebody who was too controlled of what other people thought and so on, here's what they would say. They would say, oh, it shouldn't matter what other people think of you. You shouldn't be living according to what they say. You shouldn't be living according to their standards. It shouldn't matter what they think about you. What should only matter is what? What you think about you. It shouldn't matter what their standards are. It should only matter what your standards are. Choose your own standards. Decide who you want to be, and then be it. Decide, you know, you. It all just matters what you think about yourself. Is that what Paul does? No. In other words, all we know, we in our modern world do not know how to deal with low self-esteem without what? Basically remedying it with high self-esteem. We're saying, you need to see that you're a great person. You need to see how wonderful you are. Look at all the great things you've accomplished. Look at all the wonderful things. And you just have to not worry about what other people think about you. You set your own standards and you accomplish them. And then you evaluate yourself. And Paul says, what? He says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Then what does he say? Indeed, I do not judge myself. Let me paraphrase this. Paul says, I don't care what you think, but I don't care what I think. I have a very low opinion of your opinion of me, but I have a very low opinion of my opinion of me. Look carefully. Look what he says here. He says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. He will not fall into the trap of high self-esteem. Will not. He says, just because my conscience is clear, maybe my conscience is clear, that doesn't mean I'm innocent. Hitler might have had a clear conscience. That didn't mean he was innocent. It's a trap to say, it doesn't matter what other people think. Don't worry about their standards. You just set your own standards. That's an answer. That's an answer. Listen, I feel terrible when I cannot live up to my parents' standards. I feel terrible when I can't live up to your standards. I feel terrible when I can't live up to culture standards. I feel terrible when I can't live up to other standards. So now the solution is, I set my own standards. I feel terrible when I don't live up to my standards, unless I have incredibly low standards. Is that a solution? Then I feel horrible because I said, I'm the kind of person that has low standards. Paul is not biting. And yet, when he says, I not only don't care what you think, I am not looking to you for my identity, and I'm not looking for verdicts, the verdict that Madonna's looking for, that I'm somebody. I don't get it from you, but I don't get it from me. And here's what he's doing. He is moving off of our map, friends. He's moving into territory that we don't know anything about. Because here's what he's doing. Some people think, well, he's got high self-esteem. Look, he says his conscience doesn't bother him. He says he doesn't judge himself. Good, you shouldn't condemn yourself. But that's not what the word judge means. The word judge here means a verdict, whether positive or negative. And here's what he's saying. We know this. Paul is off our maps because Paul, we know, was a man with incredible ballast. He was one of the, I don't think it's so horrible, it'd be hard to argue against this, one of the 5, 6, 7 most influential leaders in the history of the human race. one of the most influential people in history. He had enormous ballast. He had incredible confidence. He moved ahead. Nothing fazed him. And yet he says in 1 Timothy, there's a place where he says, Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. Not I was chief, I am chief. And that is off of our maps. How can somebody have incredible confidence and say, I'm one of the worst people? How can somebody be absolutely honest and aware of all kinds of moral flaws yet have incredible poise and confidence? We can't do that. You know why? Because we're judging ourselves. And when Paul says, I don't let you judge me, I don't even judge me, here's what he means. He says, I know about my sins, but I don't connect them to me and my identity. They're not connected. I don't play that game. I don't see a sin and then say, bad job, so I'm bad. Oh no, over here, good job, so I'm good. He says, I get rid of the so am. There's no connection. I don't play that game. I see all kinds of sins, I see all kinds of accomplishments, and they do not connect. That's the reason why, yeah, I'm one of the chief of sinners. That's not going to stop me from doing the things that I'm called to do. And we do not know anything about that. All we know is if I thought I was a bad person, and I thought I was a sinner, if I thought I was filled with pride, and if I thought I was filled with lust, and I thought I was filled with anger and greed, and all the things that Paul says he's filled with, I wouldn't have any confidence. No, because you're judging yourself. You set your standards. Congratulations. And now you're condemning yourself. Because the ego will never be satisfied that way. Never. What Paul says is something astounding. I don't care what you think, and I don't care what I think. And Paul is bringing us into new territory that we don't know anything about, because Paul's ego is not puffed up, it's filled up. And here's what he's saying. He is saying, and this is why I almost hate to use the word humility, because it's not like anything that you think of as humility or we think of in the world as humility. He is saying, I have come to the place where my ego does not draw any more attention to itself than any other part of my body. I have come to the place where I'm not thinking about myself anymore. When I do something wrong, when I do something right, I don't connect it anymore. I'm not thinking about myself. That's why C.S. Lewis says, in a fascinating little spot at the very end of his chapter on pride, he says, do not imagine if you meet a truly humble person. Now, he's talking about gospel humility. He's talking about the kind of Christian humility we're talking about here. He says, don't imagine if you met a really humble person, you would ever come away from him thinking he was humble. He will not be somebody who's always telling you he's a nobody, because see, that's actually a self-obsessed person. That's a person who's judging himself, either up or down, doesn't matter. He says, all you will remember from coming away from a truly humble person is how much he seemed to be totally interested in you. Because the essence of gospel humility is not thinking more of yourself or thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. It's not needing to think about yourself. It's not needing to connect things. Every conversation. I'm in this room with these people. Does that make me look good? Do I want to be here? I stopped thinking about myself. The blessed rest of self-forgetfulness. An ego that's not puffed up, but filled up. You know how unique this is? Let me show you. Just to give you a couple of examples of this. This is not, in a way, is this high self-esteem? No. Is this low self-esteem? No. Certainly not. But it's not high self-esteem. It's you stop the game. He just stops it. He doesn't think, he says, I don't care about your opinion, but I don't care that much about my opinion. And that's the secret. So let me give you an example. One of the ways you could tell a really, truly gospel humble person, I know when I start to describe this person, you're going to say, I've never met anybody like that, including you. And all right, touche. But let me look at this. One mark of a truly humble person in this sense, a self-forgetful person, not a self-hating person, not a self-loving person so much, but a self-forgetful person, a person whose ego is like his toes or her toes. Okay? It just works, and it doesn't draw attention to itself. Here's one little test. On the one hand, it would never be hurt that badly by criticism. It would not be devastating. It would not bother you. It would not keep you up late. Why? Because a person who's devastated by criticism, you're putting too much stock in what other people think, right? Other people's opinion. But how does the world heal criticism, thin-skinnedness? How does it heal being thin-skinned and being devastated by criticism? What you say to yourself is, who cares what those people think? I know what I think. Who cares what the rabble thinks? I know what I think about. And the mark of a... See, you either have people who are devastated by criticism, or they're not devastated by criticism, but they don't take it. They don't listen to it. They don't actually listen to it. They don't learn from it because they say, I don't care about it. The reason it doesn't devastate me is, I know who I am. I know what I think. I know who I am. In other words, we do not know how to heal low self-esteem except with pride. And they are both horrible nuisances to your own future and to everybody around you. But a person who's self-forgetful, a person whose ego is not puffed up but filled up, when you get criticism, it wouldn't devastate you, but you'd listen to it. You'd say, oh, criticism, an opportunity to change. I mean, I don't know anybody who does that. But at least the closer you get to understanding the gospel, as I'll show you here in a second, the more you'd be like that. Friends, wouldn't you want to be somebody who doesn't need honor and isn't afraid of it? Doesn't lust for recognition, or on the other hand, be just frightened to death of it? Don't you want to kind of be the kind of person who, when you go by a window or a mirror or something, you don't look in, you don't admire what you see, and you don't cringe either? Wouldn't you want to be the kind of person who, in your imaginary life, you don't sit around fantasizing about hitting self-esteem home runs? Oh, if I could do that. Oh, if I could do that. Nor do you ever beat yourself up. Do you ever sit around saying, boy, I was stupid. I was wrong. How could I have done something like that? Wouldn't you like to be free? Wouldn't you like to be the skater who wins the silver and yet just be as excited about those three triple jumps that the gold medal winner did? You just love it just the way you love a sunrise. You just love the fact that it was done. You don't care that she did it. You don't care if you did it. You're just as happy that she did it as if you did it, because you're just so happy to see it. You say, I don't know anybody like that. That's the possibility. If you keep on going where Paul's going, you could actually start to enjoy things. They're not about you. Your work's not about you. Your skating's not about you. Your romance is not about you. Your dating's not about you. You can actually enjoy things for what they are. They're not just for your resume. They're not just to look good on your application. They're not just a way of filling up the emptiness. Wouldn't you want that? This is off the map. This is gospel humility, blessed self-forgetfulness, not thinking more of yourself like in modern cultures, or thinking less of yourself like in traditional, regimented cultures. It's thinking of yourself less. Now, how do you get it? How did Paul get it? Well, he actually tells you, though you have to read kind of closely, yet he does. He says, Number one, I don't care what you think. But number two, I don't care what I think. I don't look to you for the verdict, and I don't look to me for the verdict. And then, instead of jumping too quickly, you got to read more carefully. He says, my conscience is clear. In other words, he's saying, even if my conscience is clear, that does not make me innocent. That's what the translation says. But the word is, that does not justify me. And the word he uses is the word justified, the same word he uses all through Romans, the same word he uses all through Galatians. And here's what he's saying. He says, what Madonna's looking for, what we're all looking for, is an ultimate verdict that we're important and that we're valuable. And every time we think we've done it, it doesn't seem to be there. And what that means is the world, every single day, we go to trial. We're in a courtroom every day. You notice how Paul says, I don't care what you think about me or what any human court thinks. Now, that is odd. They're not a court. The people he's writing to aren't a court. Why would he say, I don't care about what you think or any human court? He's talking, I think, metaphorically. And what he's trying to say is, the problem with self-esteem, high or low, the problem with the way almost everybody's normal identity works, is that every single day, you're in the courtroom, you're on trial, and there's prosecution and there's defense. And everything you do, you're stamping evidence for the prosecution, evidence for the defense. And some days you feel like you're winning the trial, and some days you feel like you're losing a trial. And Paul says, I have found the secret. The trial's over for me. I'm out of the courtroom. It's gone. It's over. Because the ultimate verdict is in. Now, how could that be? He says it very simple. You cannot justify me. I cannot justify myself. What does he say? It is the Lord who judges me. His opinion only counts. And in Jesus Christ, and only in the gospel of Jesus Christ, do you get the verdict before the performance. Do you see this? The reason, it doesn't, whether you're an atheist, you say, well, I get my self-image from just being a very good person, fine. What you mean is, if I'm a good person, eventually I hope for some kind of verdict that I'm a good person. In other words, performance leads to the verdict. If you're a Buddhist, performance leads to the verdict. If you're a Muslim, performance leads to the verdict, which means every day you're in the courtroom, every day you're on trial. That's the problem. But Paul says, in Christianity, the verdict leads to performance. The performance does not lead to the verdict. Christianity, when the minute I believe, God says, you are my beloved in whom I'm well pleased. The verdict is in. Now, Romans 8, chapter 1, chapter 8, verse 1, now there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. The verdict is in. And now I perform on the basis of the verdict. He loves me. He accepts me. Now I don't have to do things just to build up my resume. I don't have to do things to make me look good. I can do things to do things. I can help people to help people. Not so I can feel better about myself. Not so I can fill up the emptiness. Every other form of identity, which you say, what's going to make me have a sense of worth is I'm liberal or I'm a conservative. I'm a good person. I'm a free person. Whatever. I'm religious. I'm moral. Whatever. It's always the performance leads to the verdict. But the verdict is never there. It never comes. Madonna said so, and she ought to know. Madonna has done things that you're never going to do, and it's still not enough. Madonna is more talented than anybody in this room. Madonna is gutsier than anybody in this room. She's done all kinds of stuff. And she says, guess what? I've gone way beyond anything that you've ever done. Guess what? The ultimate verdict that I'm looking for is not come yet. But Christianity, instead of the performance leading to the verdict, which it never does, the verdict can lead to the performance. How could that be? And here's the answer. Paul's out of the courtroom. Paul's out of the trial because Jesus went to trial. Because Jesus went into the courtroom. Because Jesus Christ became a lamb that was sheared, was like dumb before its shearers, and he was struck in his trial, and it was a kangaroo trial, and it was an unjust trial, and he was put to death. Why? As our substitute. He took the condemnation we deserved. He took the trial we deserved, so we don't have to have any more trial. So the minute I say, Lord God, accept me because of what Jesus has done, then the only person's opinion who counts looks at me and finds me more valuable than all the jewels that are under the earth. How can you worry about being snubbed now? How can you worry about being ignored now? How can you care that much about what it looks like in the mirror? You say, I wish I believed this, and here's the only thing I can say at the end. There's some people here who hopefully have never understood the difference between Christian identity and any other kind. They say, well, you're a Christian. That means you're very good, and you go to church, and you hope that someday God will take you in. No, don't. The Christian identity operates totally different than any other kind of identity. That's the reason why it leads to this blessed self-forgetfulness. It takes you out of the courtroom. It takes you, the trial's over. The verdict is in. Some of you have never seen that. Go find out what that means. Figure out the parts. I mean, I went fast. You know, you say, well, why does Jesus have to die? There's a lot more to it. If you're new, stay and keep coming till you understand the whole picture. There's a whole lot of others of you that say, you know, I believe everything you said, of course. I've been coming for years, and every day I find myself being sucked back into the courtroom. And I'm not living like Paul says, and not living the way Paul is. I'm getting sucked back in. All I can tell you is you have to relive the gospel every time you pray, every time you come to church. And you have to relive the gospel on the spot. You have to say, what am I doing in this courtroom? Court is adjourned. I don't care what you think. I don't even care what I think. I only care what the Lord thinks. And he has said, you are my beloved child in whom I'm well pleased. Live out of that. Let us pray. Give us what we need, Father, to develop this blessed self-forgetfulness. This is not really pride, of course, but it's not even the kind of, it's not low self-esteem, it's not high self-esteem. It's so hard to even describe. We just ask that you would help us to pull it into our own lives and begin to practice it. Think of how different we would be. Think of how free we would be. Show us how we can make this more central. Show us how we can live out of it. Help us to be everything that we can be in Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.